I've got a story for you. Story of my life. How's that? Yeah. We'll go blow by blow here. Just narrated with pottery. So, I'm a potter. I like to start with that statement that I'm a potter, and I'm kind of a potter. I believe in pottery as an art form, so I pursue that as much as I can. And I make this first group of slides just a sort of a range of different things that I, different forms that I work on. And along the way, I can tell you that I work with stoneware, high temperature stoneware and porcellaneous stoneware, which means it has a little less iron in it, and a lot of glaze. I really like glaze and the way it melts and runs together. And everything comes off of the potter's wheel. Everything starts with the potter's wheel, and then things get hand-built from there. Pottery's a good framework as far as that's my sense about it, because it keeps my hands active. I never have to really think about what I'm supposed to do. I'm making pottery, and then things come out of that. So I make a lot of these jar forms. Sometimes they have lids, like the one you just saw, and sometimes they don't. But I think about them as just a sort of expression of shape, and the jar has a long archetypal existence. I mean, jars sort of define humanity in a lot of ways. I think every home needs a jar. It could be one of mine, but doesn't necessarily have to be one of mine. It could be somebody else's, but it's sort of an identifier, if you will. And I like them for a nice big surface to paint and draw on as well. So I fire mostly in a wood-fired kiln, and then I usually introduce salt and soda into the kiln. I'll tell you a little bit more about that as we go along. So sometimes they have lids, and sometimes they don't. Like, this is kind of a cookie jar size, and I like that sort of play of architecture with lids and the way that works. That can be a lot of fun. This is an old, little bit older pot, but I also really like pitchers. My students will chuckle because I make them make pitchers, but pitchers and pouring vessels of all different kinds are some of my favorite things to make, because they're very animated, I feel like. And anytime you put a spout and a handle on a form like that, I feel like they kind of come alive. They become some kind of character. And so I love that play. And I love the idea of building things and making parts and then building them together. So I make a lot of pictures like this and then paint them in different ways. These work particularly good for beer. I usually call them beer pitchers. If you have a keg of beer, they work good because the foam stays down inside the body, and then the spout separates out the nice beer. And they're fun too, right? You know, you can talk about them. Sometimes we make pitchers like this and put them with sets, and then I make these tumblers. Have lots of pretty colors on this one. And teapot forms. Yeah, animation. I mean, these spouted forms are, you know, I rarely make tea. I like tea, but I rarely make tea. But I really like making teapots, and I like the character that they become. I also make these ewer forms, and I like this one quite a bit. I have to confess, it doesn't pour that well, but who cares? You know, the spout's got great character on it, I think. So this was one from this summer, and the glaze was particularly nice. Sometimes these get paired with sets. So these are, I call these liquor sets. And liquor sets are, you know, I think libations are important. That I love the idea of this, of not just because it's liquor, but it's just like this idea about like taking time with your friends. Just to take a moment and to celebrate a little bit, so this becomes the center of that. And then sometimes these little spouted forms turn into oil and vinegar sets. And again, it's kind of an opportunity for characters. So these are characters sort of floating down the river. They'll come up again in the show. Sometimes they become oil oil pots. I was making these for a while. I haven't made these for a little while, but I kind of like this one. It's pretty juicy. That's a technical term, juicy. But these are for oil. I think about them for oil because then you could have it right on the counter. You know, you should try to think about how many pots you can put on your counter just because it makes your day a little bit better, you know. These are also a fairly new form. These are some little terrine kind of bean pots or soup pots that are a little bit goofy. Kind of working on that, but out of these, this came out of those, which was kind of cool. And this is a butter dish, and butter dishes are pretty critical if you think about it. Butter is a pretty critical thing. It's like bacon, you know. You got to have butter. So butter is a pretty good thing, and then the dish makes the lid makes a nice little dish with that foot. That's an old pottery idea. You make a lid, and then you can turn it over, and it becomes a foot. Chinese, they thought about that a long time ago. I also make these basket forms too, and these kind of come from this love about making handles. These are kind of handles going wild, or handles gone wild, something like that. And they're just, I like this sort of lyrical quality of the pulled handle and how it can build upon itself. So I just start at the bottom and make the first set and let those set up a little bit and then pull the next set and then the next set and the next set. And they're kind of these, and it's sort of like a tension, you know, sort of exploring the tension in the handle and how to get it to spring just right is how I think about them. So I've also been working on this new bird bath idea. This was a commission that kind of went haywire, but I've been having fun with it a little bit. But I've got these hanging bird bath things going right now they've got a lot of glaze on them. If the bird lands in it, they'll just become part of the glaze, I think. Yeah. Could be pretty fun. So they're kind of fun. And I make a lot of platters too, and I usually fire these platters upside down on top of the other pots. And part of the reason I like to do that is because the colors in a atmospheric wood fire kiln, like I fire, generally come out better on the bottom of the pot. So you know, turn the pot over, make that the front. So these are fired upside down, like perched on top of a lot of the jar forms. And the other benefit about that is that it kind of nestles right up into the arch of the kiln, so that works out pretty good. The other thing I do with these is I put these tripod feet on the bottom of them. You can just see one little nubbin sticking out here on the bottom. And that allows me to like let them bend and warp. Clay warps. We call it clay deformation. It's a great word, right? But it bends and warps, and that's usually we call that a flaw, ceramic flaw, but it's so beautiful, like that curve of what can happen in the firing. So with a tripod, it'll always find a home. It's always kind of stable. I mean, the stuff might spill out the front, but it still doesn't rock around. So we like tripods. And then when I fire them upside down, I perch them on top of these pieces of seashell, or sometimes fake seashell, which is kind of that's a funny thing, because you can make fake seashell with plaster and whiting, and then you smear it out on cardboard, and it looks just like a scallop shell. Let you in on the joke here a little bit. But so these big marks in the middle of this, where there's five marks there, they're sitting on, it was just perched on top of one of the other jars in the kiln. So then the glaze all runs backwards too. It runs up out of the middle of the pot too, and that's sort of a fun thing to play with too. Sometimes they get stacked on their side too, and then the glaze just flies right off of them, like this one. Sometimes I can get the drips to go straight up. It's pretty amazing, really. When drips come out going straight up, then I've had a pretty good kiln. I feel pretty excited about that. This is like just a wall tile, and it's about maybe an inch and a half thick or so, weighs about 100 pounds, and hangs on the wall. That's not quite 100 pounds, but it's very thick, heavy clay, which I like also. It's about 2 feet by 16 inches, something like that. I'm a potter. Remember I told you that. So I make a lot of cups. Cups, I think cups are probably some of the most important pots that I get to make because they're very intimate. I love the intimacy of a cup and the way you can get up close and personal with it. I mean, up, really up close and personal. You know, you kiss it. That's pretty intimate. You don't kiss paintings usually, right? But with a cup, I love the way a cup can live in people's lives, and the way it is there's such a relationship to the hand and the sort of haptic thing that happens with them. And I think about them sort of as a three-dimensional painting. You know, there's a drawing that moves all the way around the cup too. So I love the relationship that people develop with a cup over a long period of time and how it becomes their favorite cup. And people have this cup and they're like, that's mine. You can't have that cup. Don't touch that cup. And there, if you break a cup, your favorite cup, it's a bad day, you know. It's a bad day, but it's good for potters, right? Because we get more. They're accessible too, you know. I mean, everybody can have a cup. Everybody can afford a cup usually. And so they're kind of like the gateway drug. That's, if you get people hooked on a cup, they might come back for a jar someday. So a lot of cups in different shapes, forms. I like to pair them up. Different shapes, forms. And a few more. The ones up on the top are like steins. You know, you need steins too. And then tea bowls too, or just cups that don't have a handle. And the way you engage with this is just with your hand. You know, it's very personal. Like you hold it in two hands usually, and you can feel it on. Think about a nice cup of hot tea on a cold morning, and how you drink out of it. That really sensuous lip. So I like to make a lot of cups. So this is my partner Rosie Winecoop that many of you know. Best things happened in my life for sure. And these are some of the pots that she made in her time. And now she makes these beautiful gardens. And we have a great home that's out by Four Corners, out behind the Bozeman Hot Springs. We found a nice little spot back there. I feel very, very lucky to have this spot. And I can walk to the hot springs in the morning, so pretty good deal. Walk to the river the other way, 10 minutes one way to the river, 10 minutes to the hot springs. So it's pretty nice. This is the Rainbow Subdivision. It's the oldest subdivision in Montana. First one on the books. And we live on the corner of Magenta and Indigo. So that's pretty good. So Rosie runs bees too, and I help her with that a little bit. And then I work in the studio that we were fortunate enough to build. And that's a shot of the studio down there on the left with a wood kiln. And then this is Chris Bienick, who was a former student and went away for a while and then came back when we were opening the studio and worked out that he is able to work there and he helps with making all sorts of things. Really helps a lot with the firings and keeps the studio nice and clean. And we get along pretty good. So that's a pretty good deal. And this is, many of you will recognize, this is Cottonwood Canyon. So I have talked about this. I grew up here, right? So this is a really special place. And you come around the corner coming out Cottonwood and go in there, and go into that canyon. It's like, it'll always be like going home there. And my parents, this is Bob and Jenny DeWeese, and they were pretty special people. I feel very, very fortunate, very privileged to have landed into this family, you know, and have three sisters and a brother. They were all gone when I was growing up, or they were around a little bit, but they were older, and I was an oops baby 10 years later. So I had broken in parents, but I was pretty much an only child. So that was a pretty good deal. This was an entryway into the home. And my father liked to think about this. The house was like an art gallery. You know, he just would rearrange things all the time and put different things out there. And it was always like this. I thought everybody lived like this, you know. And got to live with things like this. So these are just a few examples of pots that we had in our home. Where our home was filled with art everywhere, all the time. Every inch, every moment was filled with art. It's pretty cool. Peter Volkas bottle here on the right, and David Shaner casserole on the top left, and Francis Senska casserole on the left. And these were, you know, the casseroles were, they were common objects on the dinner table. So that was just part of life. And we had a really exquisite Francis Senska butter dish. We had Kim Ferguson dinner plates. I mean, really amazing pottery all the time. And so when I got into making pots, these I realized that these were really, these are my teachers. Like, I knew these from a really deep place because I spent my life with them, you know. So they were important teachers for me. These are important people, too. My parents were here. They came in 1949, and this is Francis Senska and Jesse Wilbur. And they were two young faculty members who taught at Montana State College and actually hired my father. And so Francis and Jesse and Bob were kind of the core of the art building of the art school for many, many years. And so these guys were kind of like our extended family. They were at... you know, all of our Christmas Eve, they helped put all the kids' toys together and all that kind of fun stuff, you know. We'd always go over to Francis and Jesse's. Really important people for the sort of foundation of the kind of Montana modernist art scene. These guys were part of the family. So they were pretty critical to my upbringing. And of course, Francis, you've been seeing her pots, and Francis was the godmother of ceramics in the world, as far as I'm concerned, but certainly in Montana. So she was a very, very important character. And you know, she was just Francis. Pretty nice. So there's a little bit of my parents' work. This was a portrait of Rudy Audio, that he did a lot of portrait work. And he had a knack for, he could capture people's character in portraits, like, amazingly. He's always drawing. He drew incessantly, like, would drive you crazy if you're with him for more than 5 minutes. He'd have his little pad of paper out and he'd be sketching you. It's just the way he existed. So it was just sort of a fluid part of his being. These are a couple of my favorite things of his that sort of show his playfulness and his drawing. I mean, the drawing of Kmart, the St. Peter's of Bozeman. It's a pretty great piece. He did a painting of that one, too. And then the Life of Montana, those are little jelly packets making the Life of Montana building. So sort of really playful and irreverent and kind of goofy a lot of times, but really... he made some great stuff. And these are some of my mother's paintings, a few of them. An earlier landscape of the hillside, she painted what she saw. That's what she talked about quite a bit. She did a lot of landscape paintings. And the big one down here, it's called Springtime in the Rockies. It was a pretty late piece of hers, and it's a beauty. These are both scenes right out of her window, though. You know, this is what she saw all the time. And she painted all the time. This is a piece of hers that I own. It's called 9 o'clock with Charlie Rose. So it takes on a different meaning these days. She'd be heartbroken, I think. But towards the end of her time, I mean, she loved Charlie Rose, and she loved to sit and have a scotch and cigarette and listen to Charlie Rose. So this is one of my favorite paintings. And of course, my sister Tina, who many of you know, lives up the canyon in the old homestead, and takes care of that among many other things. But she's a horse. She loves horses. So I love this picture of her, and then that's some of her work. And of course, I don't have pictures of my other siblings, but they're involved in the arts too. There was kind of no escaping it in our family, so that's the way it was. My parents were really into, they were abstract expressionists when they first came. I mean, they were, period. But they brought a lot of that thinking into the Western art world of Montana, and these were a couple of their favorite painters, and consequently they are of mine too. I love both de Kooning and Diebenkorn, important painters. This is a piece of mine from, this is just a slab piece that's a just a studio drawing. I do a lot of drawings of the studio, and I think I think about my parents. Both my parents sketched a lot, and I use a black underglaze kind of marker, and I like to draw what I see. So I like a lot of times it's right there in the studio, but it's sort of these gestures about space and about shape, and then just playing with color and the way glaze will make color and line move in the firing. So the distortion of the firing becomes really important part of what happens with it. It was about 16 by 16. And then a little sketch of, pots. Yeah, there's usually pots in the studio. So a lot of sketches of pots. And another one here. Tina has this one. And then I really, these bigger jars, they're about 2 feet tall or so. They're pretty big. They're sort of friendly size. They're nice for a porch or nice for a hearth or something like that. But I like to think about them as sort of three-dimensional paintings. And I love how the drawing wraps around the painting. So again, this is a drawing in the studio. There's a ladder and there's a different references to it's a Trey Aaron's piece over there, that little clown there. They become sort of markers for me that are maybe not so recognizable for everybody else, but they're important for me. And a lot of pots on pots. And then sometimes how that drawing will work as a sort of a decorating strategy on pottery too. So this teapot's got a chair floating up the spout, and this one does too. Chairs became they're pretty common in the studio too. And then this is a woodblock print. Look, it's pots again. See, it's like pots on the brain, but this is a woodblock print. I got into woodblock prints in grad school for a little while, but this is like Mutt and Jeff floating down the river here. My mother did a lot of woodblock prints, and I've always really loved that thing, so they're fun to do. This was one of my first teachers. This is Rick Pope. Some of you will know who Rick Pope was, and this was his memorial card. That's one of my favorite things out there. It's don't let fishing get in the way of fishing. And this is classic Rick Pope here. And that's a big piece of his. He studied with a gentleman named Don Wrights, and he was always strongly influenced by Don Wrights, and therefore I was too. I don't have a picture of Don's work, but maybe on the next one. But Pope was he was sort of my very first teacher in college, and he's one who kind of took me under his wing and really sort of got me to sink my teeth into doing ceramics up here at MSU. And he's a lifelong friend and just an amazing supporter. He's the most generous character. He just would give you the world. He's a pretty amazing guy. And then I went down to school in Kansas City and worked with this guy, and this is Ken Ferguson. And he's a really different kind of character, but he is a great teacher. And this was Ken when he was a director up at the Archie Bray Foundation in Helena in the 50s. And this is a teapot of his on the right that's about maybe 20 inches tall that I own. And it's sort of a gesture of a teapot. Doesn't pour very well. You don't want to pour it. It's a sculpture, it's just a sculpture. And I love the sense of gesture in the clay and the kind of feels like sort of flabby old skin, pretty. These are great pots. Ferguson was a really important teacher for me. He was the best and the worst. He was a really big character, big physically and big sort of emotionally and all sorts of psychotically. That's right, yeah, psychotically. He was an amazing character. But the school in Kansas City was really, really terrific. It was kind of ferocious. It was 60 undergraduate students just in ceramics, and people were going like crazy all the time. And the best thing that Ferguson would do is sort of get people going, and then they'd stay out of the way and let things happen. So it was really good. And he talked about history a lot. I mean, we looked at historical work all the time. And he tried to really, emphasize that idea of like dig deep in the well, look at history, learn about history as much as you can. And there's so much to draw from. And these are just a few, a little slice of some favorite historical references. There's a Japanese Arebe tray up on the far left there, and these are Minoan jugs down here on the left, and then a Korean punchong pot too. There's another guy that was important for me. There's a young John Gill. He was a teacher in graduate school, and that's a ewer. It's not a chicken in his hand. It's a ewer. This guy was a genius with shape and form and painting, and he was a really fun teacher too. He's like taking a roller coaster ride. It was great. And then these are some other important teachers for me too that I had the fortune to work with. When I went to school in Kansas City, the very first semester, there was this elegant woman named Clary Illion who was there for one semester, and she was an Iowa studio potter that taught in Kansas City fairly frequently. That's Clary on the left, and then on the right is a potter named Jeff Astrike that I got to work with in graduate school. And it's one of those fluky things, where there's other, the regular faculty were on break, and these guys were just filling in, but they were really, really important to my thinking about pottery and about gesture on the wheel. And they had both worked with the potter Bernard Leach in England, so they were Leach apprentices, and so Bernard Leach was a really important character for the sort of field of studio pottery, and so I always kind of think of myself as a Leach potter twice removed, because I got to work with both of these guys. Great potters. This is a picture of mine that really has kind of the lineage of the Leach tradition in it. And the idea about the spout, the line coming out of the spout through the handle and back down through the belly of the pot. These are a couple of early pieces. Not that I didn't make. No, these are historical pieces. Okay, I knew you were confused there for a moment, but... one of the things I started to think about is just the range of things that qualities that we see with these great traditions in ceramics, and how you can really draw sort of bits and pieces or qualities from even the visual markers that these things represent. This is a Japanese Iga vase on the left and a Sev porcelain vase on the right that represent really, really different kind of sensibilities about beauty. And I think that I love things, they speak to me in both of them, but just in different ways. And I like to think about how you can sort of draw bits and pieces from these kind of ideas that are going on in some of these historical works and just feed them into what you're doing. They also represent, like, they're a window into a huge field of study. Each pot is just like one little window into a whole society, a whole world, a whole way of thinking that was happening in the world at that time too. Like, they represent so much. Earlier when I was looking at them, before I really thought about that very much, I thought I really loved just the raw kind of natural wood-fired marked, crusty crack thing on the Iga vase, and then the sort of elegance of the Sev vase, and the, it's very formal and kind of regal. You can hear the trumpets blaring here, And I just wanted to see if I could just get qualities from both of those things and sort of pull them into my work. I started making all sorts of goofy things, sort of referencing, sort of the high fire, runny glaze kind of stoneware thing, but with a little bit of frou-frou on it too, So this is like a soup tureen that's gigantic, and it looks like the Madonna. It's got the big boobs up on the top, but that was, again, a play on that lid where you turn the lid over and it would form two dishes. And so, when you have a big soup tureen on the table, this is like the centerpiece, right? What do you do with a lid? Well, hell, if you could turn it over, you can make another nice dish with it. So I was trying to play with that idea for a while. And then, this pitcher, it's the glaze quality feels very, very ceramic-y, really, really juicy and runny and kind of luscious. But it's kind of has this formal and kind of lyrical thing with the handle too. So just trying to think about pulling different qualities from those historical pots. It was, somewhat naive, but whatever makes you work, that's really what it's all about, right? Wherever your ideas come from that keep you in the studio and keep you going. This was a piece I did last week. I'm glad you laughed. That's good. Yeah. No. It's so cool how there's such a range of things. I mean, look at that thing. That thing is amazing. So that's a Sev. That's from Sev Porcelain. That's a French, looks French, doesn't it? I think it's pretty French. This is my version here. Kind of gooey, another liquor set here. So this is a Jomon vessel. We do a project with Jomon vessels at school, but these are prehistoric Japanese vessels that are some of the most glorious vessel forms ever made and these are really old, 10,000 years. They go way, way, way back. And they were named Jomon because they found all these shards that had lots of rope patterning on them. And so that's what Jomon means in Japanese. And so that's where the name came from. But look at those handles. I mean, oh my God, somebody's having a good time with that, definitely. So I kind of think these baskets are kind of, I think about Jomon pots a little bit with that. It's sort of a reference kind of, but just really playing with the handles and the shapes and the scale. These are pretty big. The ones on the right and the far left are about maybe 40 inches tall. This one's kind of like a Darth Vader kind of thing. It's really gnarly. And there's a little more lyrical one. Sometimes they have flowers in them. Bony handles. But I like to play with the shapes. And these are fun to draw, too. These end up on pots quite a bit. So this is the Archie Bray Foundation, the old days, and that's one of those wonderful pixelated pictures there. But this is the pottery that you see when you drive in. There's pots all over the place hanging off the roof and all sorts of things like that. So if you haven't been to Archie Bray, go. It's very close, and it's one of the most amazing places out there, and it's right here in Montana. It's a great cultural treasure. And I was a director there for a long time. First went there, I spent 18 years of my life at this place, I figured out. It's definitely a big part of my heart, and I love it. It's a resident program, primarily, so artists from around the world come work there for anywhere from a month up to 2 years. And they're literally from all over the world. They're there, also from like really different backgrounds and different career levels, which I think is one of the most interesting things, because you'll have an undergraduate student working next to a retired professor, and they're both at really different points in their trajectory, but they have something to offer to each other and things to learn from each other too. So it's like an open workshop that way. There's not structured classes or anything. It's a residency. There's also classes and workshops and a clay business and a gallery and a lot of things that happen up there, but the residency is the main reason for its existence. But it's a nonprofit art center in this cool old site, right? So all sorts of weird things can happen. Like this is a group called Project Bandaloop that were aerial dancers, aerial ballet dancers that did a performance off of one of the stacks for the beehive kilns there. Really beautiful. And great people have spent time working there, like Akio Takamori, who's a great Japanese-American artist who spent quite a bit of time there. He taught at MSU, too, for a little bit of time. A really great man, passed away a few years ago. This is Archie Bray. Really was a guy named Archie Bray. And he was, I never got to meet him, but I heard a lot of stories about him. He was quite a character. And he ran a brick factory, but he loved the arts. He was a real, true arts patron. And he studied ceramic engineering in Ohio, at Ohio State University, and the lore about it was that he had quite a few girlfriends that really clued him into culture and art and music. He loved music, loved theater, he had a dream to start like a broad art center, you know. That's originally what the Bray Foundation was going to be, was supposed to have a theater, supposed to have studios for painting and drawing, sculpture, music, and then he died. So they started with the pottery, you know, because it was a brick factory and there was clay involved, so that was the first step, and then Archie passed away. But anyway, this was him with a little pot that Bernard Leach made that he's holding that he obviously liked quite a bit. Always liked this picture. This is a shot of the Western Clay Manufacturing Company. That was a brick factory that he ran. Just an aerial shot. That actually his son, Archie Jr., took this picture. But it's kind of fun to see it. You might be able to figure out some parts of it. A lot of this stuff is gone now, but I can recognize it, but I won't be able to tell you about it. There's Archie. He's shoveling salt into a beehive kiln. So we put salt in the kiln that vaporizes and it glazes the ceramics. And this is, they used to do it for industry. They did it for brick. And he's shoveling, it's like probably 200 pounds of salt into the kiln. We usually put like 2 pounds in, you know, so this is pretty dramatic. So this is a photo of an important workshop that happened at the Archie Bray. This is a famous photograph in the ceramic world. And it's important to me for a number of reasons, because it was at the Archie Bray. And also, this from left to right, this is Soetsu Yanagi, Bernard Leach, a very young Rudy Audio, and Peter Volkas, and then Shoji Hamada, who is a great, great Japanese national living treasure potter. And Yanagi, Hamada, and Leach were traveling around the United States doing workshops and giving lectures in the early 50s, like 1950 about. And Branson Stevenson, who was one of the founders of the Bray Foundation, heard about it, and he invited them to... I just learned this today reading a thesis paper. He enticed them with this new potter's wax that he had just invented. It's pretty interesting. That was good. Yeah. So anyway, he got them to come to the Bray in 1950 for a couple of weeks to do a workshop. And that was right after the pottery had opened. They built the pottery in 1951. So young Peter Volkas and Rudy Audio spent 2 weeks working with these, you know, truly the sort of the top masters of the pottery world at that time, or the perceived masters of the world at that time. And so it was a really important kind of meeting point, because young Peter Volkas and Rudy Audio went on to become the sort of pivotal characters in transforming the American ceramic scene, right? So this was kind of a meeting of the minds that happened at the Bray in 1952. And then right past Rudy's head is this picture on the wall, and that's a print of my father made, because he was their teacher. He was their undergraduate teacher here at MSC in those days. So, you know, they were, when they started the Bray Foundation, my parents had all these great stories about Pete and Rudy coming back and saying, you know, God, we met this crazy guy. He's going to pay us to make pottery. You know, it's crazy. And so it was always fun to, like, when I ended up at the Bray, being able to sort of think back about all those stories that my mother had about those days when those guys first went up to the Bray. It was pretty cool. So they did this workshop, and then here's, you know, this is Peter Volkus, who's kicking the wheel for Hamada, because Hamada was used to working at sitting cross-legged and using a stick to spin a wheel. Is very traditional manner of working. And so, of course, we didn't have a wheel with a hole. We didn't have that set up, but we had a kick wheel. And so Volkus would kick the wheel for him. And so he said, God, you know, you couldn't get much closer. It was just right there. Couldn't get any closer. And Hamada would say, faster, faster, slower, slower. And people go, oh, Jesus Christ, all right. It's pretty funny. But anyway, my dad was at this workshop, and he did all these great sketches of Hamada and Leach. And so he gave these to me, and I have these little drawings. And these are probably my greatest prized possessions. I just love these things, you know. But part of what's really cool about it, they're great sketches, kind of goofy little things. But on the far left, that's Hamada's signature. And what for me, I think that's really special, because it's like an ink, you know, this calligraphy of his signature. He didn't sign his pots, you know, because he was into the idea of the unknown craftsman, and you didn't need to sign your pots. They would sort of stand on their own. But I have his signature on a drawing that Dad did, so that's pretty cool. So these are treasures. And then another important character involved at the Archie Bray is Dave Shaner, too, who was a director there for many years, about 7 years altogether. And he's truly one of my great heroes. I love this guy, and really loved his pots. His pots were very important to me, great to live with. And he had a sense of form that was just so right all the time. Really, really beautiful work. Really beautiful work. And he's a really hardcore environmentalist. Lived right outside of Glacier Park. Spent a lot of time up in the park. He got the Governor's Award 1 year, and his acceptance speech was just all about the environment. He just really railed on what was going on. It's good. So when we built a new studio building at the Bray, it was named for Shaner. So this is a Shaner studio. And then when it opened, this is Ann Shaner, his wife, his widow, and with a show of some of Dave's sort of magnificent pieces that were left for the family. And we were able to show them in the new Shaner building. It was really a beautiful show. The other thing about the Bray that was so amazing was that we got to spend time with so many different artists, Rosie and I, when we were there. And we became good friends with a lot of them, and they're from all over the world. And so now, like, traveling around the world, you can, you know, I get to go visit these guys a lot of different places. And this is one of my favorite characters named Hung Chung Lee, who's in South Korea. And this is some of his work. That's his big compound up there. And he makes ceramic furniture. Now it's a bathtub up there. And then he makes these kind of goofy things. And this is him down here. And then we went and visited another one of my favorite American Korean potters. Steve Lee had some new work on display in the Four Seasons Hotel in Seoul. So we went to see him, sent Steve a picture. So, you know, right during the Bray's 50th anniversary, Peter Held, who was a director at the Holter, and he was working on a show of the Archie Bray's 50th anniversary touring show, but he also said, you know, you should make 50 jars for the 50 years of Archie Bray. And I thought, sure, that sounds like a good idea. Why not? And I just started making these bigger pots, so they're really kind of goofy and clunky. But I said, yeah, I'll do it. And it was really fun to have a whole room full of all these different, basically the same pot, but with just so much variety with it. This was an important show for me, and it was great. I got Rudy Audio's prints were all on the wall, and I had the floor with all these pots, and it was a great experience. Earlier, I had seen, you know, this thing about jars. They come from a lot of different places. These are some pots from Mali and Nigeria, and I had the experience of seeing a big show of African storage pots at the Iowa Art Museum, and walking into a room just filled with all these big hovering black shapes. It was just one of the most moving things I'd ever seen. So when I was working on that other show, I thought about that quite a bit. And of course, they were quite different. But I just love these big jar forms and the sort of the feel of the, that you can just feel the hand on these pots. Really beautiful. And this is a terrible picture, but there's an iconic Japanese storage jar from a place called Shigaraki. So they made gazillions of these jars, and they were used for storage, but they're just beautiful markers. In Korea, these are big ongi pots. Ongi is a technique in Korea where they use coil building and charcoal, hot charcoal on the inside of the pot, so it dries quickly, and then they can add another coil and just keep building with it. And so you see these big storage jars kind of all over the place. I mean, homes, it's pretty common to see a nice big jar sitting out by home, at least a lot of the places that I saw in Korea. So these are, you know, they're pretty impressive, big storage jars. And this is one of my favorite Korean contemporary potters named Kang Hyo Lee, who's he uses that technique, the ongi technique. And I first met him when he came to Archie Bray. This was a big pot that he made at the Bray. He built this in one day, and then the slip decoration on it was just like totally out of control. It's like a big performance piece. There's really good videos of this on YouTube now that are totally worth watching. Master Korean Potter. Just YouTube that and soak it up. He's really good. So these are some of my jars, last few years. You know, it's all been about maybe 15 or 20 years now, just a little bit. Some with lids and some without. And different sensibilities about color, glaze, and pattern, and drawing, and painting. This one has a little window cut out on some of these lids. I was playing with these windows in the lids that would flash down onto the pot below it. You can see it up on the top there. And then there's this thing about wood firing, too, that I need to talk about a little bit, because it's kind of been a really important part of my work for a long time. And these are the old kilns at Archie Bray Foundation that we used to fire a lot. This was one day we got the full moon, and then we got the two kilns going. The big kiln on the far left was one that Dean Adams had built. We called the Big Heat. And when it was raging, it was a rager. And then the other one in the forefront is cross-draft kiln that Mackenzie Smith and Jeanette Rakowski built, and we were firing that same time. So this pot on the right was fired in a firing with a Norwegian artist named Torbjorn Kosbo, who is a visiting artist at the Bray. And it was a extreme firing where we fired for a long period of time. It went really hot, and then he'd let it cool off and then fire it again, fire up a little bit more, cool off, up and down. So what that would do is sort of build up layers of surface on the work. And when the stuff came out of the kiln, like it comes out of the kiln and it is fried. I mean, it is brown beyond brown beyond brown, but it is so magical. It's like these things, they come out of the kiln, you look at it and you go, oh my God, what happened? Oh Jesus. You know, oh God, got to do it again. You know, it just sucks me in like crazy. So I like to think about it as compressed geology in a way. So it's sort of like it's all these forces in nature that you're kind of controlling and getting to happen in a really really, you know, compressed amount of time that way. So some of the services can be really, really spectacular and beautiful. This is the wood soda kiln up at the Bray, and this is sort of like a mistress to me. Sorry, honey, but it's really, I love this thing here. I mean, and the reason, every time this kiln fired, it probably fired maybe 100 times when I was at the Bray, and I got to have pots in it every time. Like, I fired it a lot. And so I got to be really familiar with this kiln. I knew exactly how to make it work, and I got a lot of really good pots out of this kiln. So, you know, a kiln is like that. It's like a brush. You know, you sort of learn how to put things in different parts of the kiln so you get certain qualities, and you learn that over time. And wood kiln kind of amplifies that quite a bit. But I love having a long-term relationship with a kiln like this. It's really special. This kiln's still around, but it's probably going to be taken down. It's a great kiln. This was one that came out of it. Shelf broke in the middle of the firing, so the pot was standing vertically, and then it fell over, and all the glaze was just flying off the side of it. This was pretty dramatic. And there's a pot that stuck to it on the bottom. And then there's drips coming off the lip and stuff. But the little pots, with the big ones, it's nice. The little ones, you just break them off with a hammer. Doesn't matter so much. Just break them off. No problem. There's another one that got torched quite a bit. That was in the big heat kiln. And another one from, this was from a kiln down in, at the LH project down in Joseph, Oregon. So these are my kilns I get to play with right now, or not all of them, but well, the main kilns here. So up on the far left is the new kiln out at my house that is I think it's my favorite kiln now for sure. It's a great kiln. And we've fired it about 25 times now, and so it's working pretty good. And it's fired with all scrap wood, which is pretty amazing. Scrap wood that's delivered, that's a pretty good deal. Then the kiln down here on the left is a goofy spaceship-looking thing, isn't it? It's a great photo that Jeff Conger took of Dave Peters' kiln out at the graduate studios. And then this is a wood soda kiln that's at school. This was the first kiln that I ever built over here on the right. There was a class at school. And I've been around a lot of kiln building, but that was the first one that I really said, okay, you put the brick here, you put the brick here. Put it here. I had to figure it out. It's pretty good. And these were all student built. The one out of our house was a class, which was pretty cool. I had hernia surgery like the next week, and so I'd say, "You guys lift those bricks over here. 20,000 pounds of brick. We figured it out. It's pretty amazing." This is Cray. We love Cray. This is a big pile of wild clay that's from up in Canada at the Plainsman Clay Pit outside of Medicine Hat, Alberta. So this has become a passionate thing too, is just this raw material and this wild clay stuff. So this is one of those big Ongi pots at Archie Bray Foundation that was made by another Ongi potter who was there at the same time that Kong Hyo was there. And a guy named Oh Hung Jung. And then we're glazing it with a glaze that this character on the left, his name is Morgan Ringer. And he was sort of a geologist, natural kind of geologist guru guy. And he'd always come in with all these materials that he had collected somewhere out around the Helena area. And he said, "Here, try a little bit of this on your pot." And so he said, "I'll make this glaze up, and we'll glaze this big Ongi jar with it." So we did, and then the glaze comes out like this. It's like this, this is like one stone, pretty much. This glaze is made from one ground-up rock, except for the blue. The blue is another color. But that kind of golden hare's fur thing was a diorite granite glaze that Morgan had developed. And he gave me the leftover bucket of it, and I was like, "Oh my God, let me have." I just totally fell in love with this stuff. I'd come out of the kiln, and I'd be like, "Oh my God, it's so beautiful. Oh, give me more of that. So it kind of got me really turned on to making glazes with local natural materials. And so, you know, and then I started thinking about how, you know, when we look at the great traditions of ceramics in the world, you look at the work, the work really is defined by the geology from that place. I mean, it certainly has a big part to do with it. Like China, you know, why do we call it porcelain China? They developed it in China. There's a 20-foot tall porcelain piece that was made in China. And then that's a Korean celadon bowl. And both of these places are examples of where the geology was, the materials were prevalent there to make this happen. And so now we get all of our clay from one pit somewhere out in Ohio. You can lay in bed with your smartphone and order clay from New Zealand and have it delivered to your door. It's a really different thing, right? And that's great. Don't get me wrong, I'll do it. I like color that comes out of a bottle that way, but I also started to think about how dumb we get about this stuff. It's sort of like we're becoming brain dead to the potential of what happens in your local world. So when I got to MSU, Dean Adams, my friend Dean, said, "Hey, we should start the Wild Clay Research Center." And I said, "Yeah, that's okay. That sounds like a great idea. Let's do that." And then the university said, "You can't call it a center. It doesn't work like that. You don't have enough money." So we said, "How about if we call it a project? Can we call it a project?" "Sure, you can call it a project." And then our new director, Vaughn, said, "You should call it an international wild clay research project." And he was right on the money, because you know what? This stuff happens all over the world and you got to go learn about it. So really good way to learn about things is to write a grant and go visit how they do it, which is what I've been doing for quite a few years now. It's very effective. So these are a few scenes from around Montana where we go out and dig different clays, and then we try and get students to eat the clay too, and you really do, because your teeth it's really sensitive. So you're sort of checking for grain size, like with the material. Just a little bit, you can feel it. You can feel how fine it is between your teeth. Try it. Next time you go out, just grab a piece of mud. It's great. But geologists will tell you this isn't bullshit. It's really true, actually. But then, so this is digging clay up in Lewistown, and then that's a place down in by Dillon called Red Earth and Dice Creek. Great stuff. And, of course, the godmother of this was Frances. This is Frances Senska, and she dug her clay out of necessity, really, but they dug them around. She dug it around Montana, loved the clay from Lewistown. That was what we were digging in that earlier scene there. And these are some of her pots. And then her glazes came from all these different sites around Montana as well, too. And you know, this was an important part of her thinking about ceramics. So, you know, it's pretty cool. Frances started the ceramics program at MSU, you know, and she sort of did this out of necessity, but it's nice to think that a lot of it is happening there again, so that's pretty good. These are some local clay glazes. Trail Creek is one of our favorite ones over there on the far left, just straight out of the ground and polished in a ball mill. It's amazing stuff. Right up past Sarah's house, amazing stuff. And that's been used by potters around here for many, many, many years. It's a really great material. Then on the right is a mix of wood ash and some other clays from up by Helena and from Lewistown on the bottom. But there's the thing about the local materials for glaze materials, they're really utterly unique. You know, they're so, each one is unique. And they're not all beautiful, of course, but there's some potential there with it that's really amazing. And of course, Potter's been doing this forever, you know. But I think it's a good thing to be thinking about. So these are different places around the world. China, this is where they're pulverizing kaolin. This was a Celadon school that we're involved with in South Korea that we're not working with anymore, but it was pretty interesting for a period of time. This is Joe Guile, who is one of our undergraduate students. And they were looking for all the same materials that made these really classic celadons in Korea in the Goryeo dynasty, which are reputed to be the best in the world. They're exquisite. And this is a woman down in Chile, named Victorina, who did these amazing pots built, you know, they used all local materials. And then she fired with dung. And I love the pyrometer there. We're seeing how hot the dung would get. It was like 1,000 centigrade. It was amazing. Got really hot. And then she'd fire with cow pies, and then she'd douse it with horse turds, because she could powder that up and then make this really beautiful. So they'd pull the red hot pots out of the cow dung firing and put them into the pit, and then just douse them with the ground up horse turds, make these really beautiful black. They're gorgeous. There's a guy in Italy, Mario Mariani, and his clay comes right off the hillside behind the pottery, and it's got a lot of lime in it, which for pottery, that's a bad deal because the lime expands and it makes it all crack and fall apart and disintegrate. But what they do is they just take the pot when it comes out of the kiln, and as soon as it's cool, like warm, not hot any longer, but warm, they submerge it in water. And all the lime, the edges of the lime sort of soften, and then it keeps it from cracking apart. And it actually makes them stronger. They call it gardenware. Amazing, beautiful pots. Pretty cool. Figured out how to use the stuff right on his backyard, you know. And then this is Shigaraki too. The clay in Shigaraki is one of the great sort of archetypal kaolins in the world, that is a really beautiful wood-fired clay it's abundant everywhere, so it's just amazingly, they wood-fire kilns everywhere. There's a shot from Thailand where they use the local clay, and of course is Angkor Wat. This was from a sabbatical trip, which was really one of the great things about working at Montana State University, is this thing about getting to have a sabbatical every once in a while. So these are my colleagues, Jeremy Hatch and Dean Adams. And Dean's working up in Montana Hall now, but he's a clay guy too. So we have a good time, and we have a great time with the students. This is a project I do every semester with the advanced students as a dinner party. And it's just that idea about really using pots with your food, and we have a celebration, and everybody always has a good time. It's fun to have my mother used to be able to get many, 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 many pots on the table, so I like to see if I can outdo her. And then, you know, we like to think about Montana as the whole place for all the students, because there's so much activity and clay going on in the state. These are just some of the characters. And you can learn about all the different ceramic artists in Montana by going to montanaclay.org. Julie Galloway started that up in Missoula, and so it's a pretty good network. We meet every year, and we try to get the students together as much as we can. And then we travel around, do different projects. We're building a kiln in Brazil, and this was a project just happened this fall. That's a toucan that came right in the back door there. It's pretty amazing. Flew in right behind the kiln. The guy was all pissed off because they eat all the fruit and stuff. Get out of here. I was like, oh my God, it's so cool. Look at that. Amazing. So yeah, our dean is involved with a Biennale in Curitiba, Brazil. And so we've had two projects going down there. Several years ago, Jeremy and Dean went down and worked with students to build a leg of a kiln that's on the back end of this kiln. And then this year, we went back and built a small kiln that turned into a gigantic kiln on the front side of the chimney. So it's one chimney with two kilns. And it's part of a Biennale project that happens in Curitiba at this wonderful art center with really wonderful people. And it's been an interesting experience to work on that. And of course, you know, in Montana, we build kilns like this. This is a unique design that is, you have to fire this really fast. Yeah. So this was, last year we had a lot of snow, and the old kiln was about ready to come down. So the guys built a little onagama in front of the other kiln. I just loved it. It's just fantastic. So then we just built this, too, this summer. And we got all these brick from a site over in Butte. We got 22 pallets of brick for free, and we had to truck them down here, so it was virtually free. But then we have a lot of brick to build kilns with. Been building a lot of kilns lately. It's just like a little bit too much work, but it's kind of fun. But this is the same idea. There's one chimney in the middle and two kilns on either side. So there's a gas kiln on this side, and then a little wood fire kiln on the other side. And Alex, our grad student Alex, has been working very hard getting the plumbing done, so it's about ready to go. And we even put a roof on this one. It's very exciting. Jeremy welded up a storm. And Carlos, Matt, everybody's working so hard on this. Now it works. It's pretty good. This is wild clay at its best.